the Criterion Quest, a continuing podcast series looking at important classics and contemporary films. I'm Chris, and sitting on the couch next to me, as always, is my wonderful co-host, Tom.
Hello.
And we just finished watching Preston Sturges' 1941 film, The Lady Eve. Yeah. I almost said The Lady Vanishes just then.
it's an easy mistake to make.
They both have, you know, 2 out of 3 ain't bad with the words and similar time frame, but...
They both have lady in the title.
Yes, so. And the word the. That's about where the similarities end.
Very good.
Yeah. But,
That could be it.
Yeah, I guess plot synopsis? Do you want to break this one down?
This film... I'm shit at synopsises. But I'll keep going. This film follows Charles Pike, the son of a very rich... entrepreneur?
No, brewer.
Of course. The Pike Ale.
Yes. The ale that won for Yale.
Yeah, apparently. Henry Fonda plays Charles Pike, son of billionaire Pale Ale, Pike's Ale Brewery. And he is played by 3 crooks, con men and women, who are by the names of Harry, the father of Jean, or the Lady Eve later on.
Yep.
And I can't remember the third guy's name. It starts with G.
Gregor or something like that.
Some stupid
or
thing.
Or Gerald.
It doesn't matter. Gerald sounds right.
Yeah.
I probably should look this up. Yeah, don't worry about it.
Yeah.
And of course, the film is just a character play between the con men and women, and well, mainly Barbara. What's her name?
Barbara Stanwyck. Yeah.
And Henry Fonda falling in love versus the lies and deceit of the con man game.
Yeah, it's nice. You get that nice interplay between are they actually in love or is it all part of the long con? She's conning him to try and get marriage and money and whatever out of him. It's that thing of, as tends to happen in romance films, they fall in love in the process.
Yes, love often is in romance films,
yes.
Chris.
but I had never seen this movie before, and I fucking loved it.
Me too.
I really enjoyed this movie. The first thing that kind of really jumped out to me was... I'd seen, obviously, Henry Fonda in things like Grapes of Wrath and On Golden Pond and 12 Angry Men and things. Once Upon a Time in the West, of course. Very serious and austere roles.
Mm.
And same with Barbara Stanwyck. I would mainly know her from Double Indemnity, the Billy Wilder film, where she plays a woman who convinces a man to kill her husband for insurance money, and very duplicitous and very evil character. I thought it was really fucking great to see both of them having so much fun and almost slapstick in this film. I'd never really seen... Henry Fonda in that kind of light.
He was a playfully naive character. Yeah, and you're right. I've never seen him do that role.
Mm.
Charming gentleman.
Yeah. To put it in a modern day kind of context, what it reminds... Like, the note I wrote down while watching was, if this movie was made today, the Henry Fonda role would be played by either Paul Rudd or Bill Hader.
Yeah, it's totally a Paul Rudd situation.
Yeah, but he kind of had that nice naivete that kind of reminded me a little bit of... I'm not the biggest fan of this movie, but Bill Hader's character in Trainwreck, I thought,
I haven't seen that. Mm. Sorry, I can't have that conversation with you.
No, yeah, I mean, honestly, you are not missing much.
I never fucking heard of that shit.
It's fine. It's fine.
It's not a recommendation.
It's a Judd Apatow movie, so it has scenes that go on for 5 minutes longer than they need to, because it's...
They were good, and then...
But then they started going for like 3 hours, and just scenes go on for too long.
Yeah.
But, that's the thing that kind of stood out to me immediately with this film was the playfulness of these two actors that I mostly know for doing very serious work.
Mm.
And that immediately kind of hooked me in and was like, I want to see where this goes. These two great actors that I've never seen do this type of acting, and they did it fucking phenomenally, I thought.
Yeah, well, Barbara Stanwyck, or Jean...
Mm.
She, to me, was... I mean, I was expecting Fonda to be just kill it.
Yeah.
As he always does.
Yes.
But Stanwyck was fucking amazing. There's that, I think, 5 minutes into the film, there's the mirror sequence.
Yeah, yeah.
Where she is sitting down, assessing the inadequacy of all of the other potential suitors, or would you call it just the females that are kicking around.
Yeah, after, on the cruise ship, yeah.
Yeah, after Charles's money or image or whatever.
Yeah.
The title of the whole thing.
She's assessing all the other vapid people that are trying to pretty much essentially do the same thing she's doing, but
yeah,
but she's but copying to the fact that she is doing it for the
yeah,
money.
But,
yeah,
but that's but there's the charm. There's the
yes. Yeah.
She knows. She's like, I can do this. You guys are just fucking shit at winning this guy over. You need to be different rather than the same.
You've never played this game before.
Watch the master.
I have done this. Yeah. Yeah,
I'm the fucking con woman here.
Yes, exactly. You don't know shit.
And
the way.
The mirror sequence, it seemed like it was just so far beyond anything you would expect from a 1940s film.
I dare say something you would even see today in a like generic mainstream film. Because, like, let's be honest, like that's what this film is. At its core, it is a popcorn romantic comedy.
Yeah.
But what Preston Sturges does in that scene alone is elevate the film so much higher than any other stock standard romantic comedy of this era.
Mm.
It's phenomenal. It's proving like that this is a master. Like, he's a master filmmaker at work here.
But let's just break that down further, because
my statement or the scene?
Because
my statement was very hyperbolic.
Yeah, it's too broad.
Mm.
But let's slow down, because this scene, as I said, 7 minutes into the film.
Yep.
And it just captures you because you have the most, I would say, one of the most charismatic women I've seen on screen, man. Like, I didn't
ever.
Even...
Wow.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. I'm going to say that because she was so natural and sensual and sexy. And so it was down to even just the dialogue. The writing was just so fucking sharp.
Punchy
and refined.
As shit, yeah.
Yeah, and as you say, it elevates it to this next level of popcorn film.
Yeah,
where
yeah.
It's at that sweet spot where you have something that's accessible to pretty much anybody, everywhere, but to those that really want to have more than just a popcorn piece, you get to latch on to
there's a lot of meat on the bones of this film. Like, it's got something for you to like. The someone that is going to a popcorn film but wanting something more, it's there for them. Like, they can really, it's got meaty good example. It's like seeing a fuck. I know what you're saying. It's kind of hard to formulate this thought and express it. I got a good example.
Yeah,
it's like seeing a Coen Brothers film.
Okay. Yes.
Where
yes,
you go in, like, to see a generic, or like, you know, some of their trailers, especially early on in their careers, they were, like, a good example would be, like, Burn After Reading. I know that's not early on, it's contradictory.
Could go, like, Big Lebowski or something.
Yeah.
Very easy to get into, very, very watchable.
And and the dialogue is so rich and meaty and quick and back and forth that if you're a fan of that, you fucking latch onto it immediately. And that's like with all their films. Like, and in the case with this film, The Lady Eve, like, the dialogue and the character interplay is so rich and meaty that you just fucking latch on and you kind of want to see where the story goes and you're immediately invested.
I feel like if I was to rewatch it and rewatch it, I'd be picking up more and more nuances and subtleties in the performances.
Yeah, yeah.
I was surprised.
Yeah.
Because you don't expect the beauty of these old films is they're good when the actor is allowed to just sit there and take that role and just become passionate towards the character they're trying to portray.
Yeah.
Because usually, like, I found that in this film the editing was really fucking weird and jarring.
Okay.
You know, like, there's all these fade outs, like the scene fades out to the next scene and some passage of time occurs. And it's always really abrupt, and just it's just a product of the times where
I got an interesting counterpoint to that, but we'll save. I'll get onto that later. Like, we'll
okay,
put a pin in that, but
okay,
continue.
So to me, it was the film making itself. The editing is just stuck in the 1940s.
Yeah.
But then the camera is just put, you put the camera in front of the actors and then they just run with it.
Yes.
And that's what makes these old films, this one in particular, so captivating.
Yeah. There's that weird kind of stigma that most people of our generation have for older cinema, where it's like, it's going to be very slow and very dull and very boring. Yet, there have been, in particular, like going through the Criterion Collection, as well as like other films I know we've both seen, where you find exceptions to the rule. People like Kurosawa or David Lean or Hitchcock, like, there are those ones where you watch those films and all of a sudden you're like, oh wow, this is actually
something better. The editing in like Kurosawa film holds up because he's so far ahead of his time in that capacity.
Yes.
Then you watch these other older films and they're typically, like, I can understand if a teenager or, you know, someone that's grown up in the 80s or 90s just can't get into 1920s films and 30s films and 40s films, because the gap in filmmaking tropes and knowledge of just the technicality of making a film is so far beyond what it was.
They're used to a frenetic style and
you just can't go back, you know, it's just too much.
But
you can still rely on the actors. The actors' performances have never changed. There's always been passionate actors that allow you to just jump into the moment.
Before you jump further into that character discussion, you were just saying, like, Kurosawa, in terms of his filmmaking and the editing of his films, stands up as good then as it is today, like anything today.
Yeah.
Back to the mirror scene, I feel that the way that is shot and executed, that scene...
True.
Is as well made as anything you would see in a mainstream film.
Oh, fucking oath.
That's what I was meaning about, like, this film elevated above Head and Shoulders and proves that, like, Preston Sturges is a phenomenal director, and it's that scene alone, because you don't expect to see something that masterful and that inventive with the camera in...
Because it was... There was... just relax, mate. There was moments where you're watching, obviously, Gene holding the mirror.
Yeah.
And then you're getting another shot planted into the mirror.
Yes.
Sometimes you notice that it's... I mean, there's moments where the camera moves, that the mirror doesn't move, but the shot within the mirror moves. So it's like, it breaks the immersion of that, but... but still, that being said, I'm totally with you on that. It's a special effect. It's not a practical effect.
Mm.
It's
just an overlay, superimposing of the footage. Like, it's nothing. They do the same kind of thing when Charles gets the envelope with the photo in it.
Oh yeah.
And it's like he's overlaid. That's kind of similar. It's like one of the first special effects ever. It's just too.
It's pretty seamless. And if it's seamless in a 1941 film, then it's obviously pretty basic.
Yeah.
Certainly by today's standards.
Yeah.
But I do love the creativity. I love the.
The way to let that scene unfold.
It's just such a nice flair. You could do it in so many easier ways.
And not just that, it immediately. Because that's our introductory scene to Gene, right?
Yeah.
That is the. By the end of that scene, we know exactly who that character is.
Yeah.
With one fucking scene, beautiful scene, he's established... Because we've already had build-up and we've had exposition about Henry Fonda's character to build him up. But then his performance holds up to that exposition and kind of he makes that his own.
Well, it's kind of interesting because there's your built-up... The film builds up a picture of Henry Fonda's character, Charles, as... a man that has built, you know, potentially the best beer ever or whatever.
Oh, his family has, yeah.
Yeah, and then he's kind of become this larger-than-life character, and then when you finally do meet him, he even says, he's like, actually, I don't fucking even like beer.
Yeah, and I'm a nerd, and I'm a schlub, and I'm just a bumbling kind of everyman.
So he becomes, like, totally relatable.
Mm. But in terms of the story and the character, we're given all the information we need about him in exposition before we actually meet him.
Mm.
Whereas with Barbara Stanwyck's character, with that one scene, it's like, oh, we know what type of person she is, how she conducts herself, and that she's a con woman. Like, everything about her is established by her.
She's confident, witty, sexy,
intelligent,
highly intelligent.
Yeah, and is a con woman. Like, yeah. It's just all perfectly summed up with her not even talking about herself.
But it even goes further than that, because moments ago when you meet Harry, Jean's father,
mm-hmm.
and the first instance of meeting Jean, I think Harry says that he explains that we're crooks, not commoners.
Oh, okay, so there's that throwaway.
There's this one little sentence where it explains that they are they're con men, but they only go for big game too.
Yeah.
So
they're not crooks, they're con men. Yeah.
Yeah, well I'm trying to say that they're not common. He's actually saying there's no
There's no sport in taking money from someone who's poor. Like, they have honour in there.
What was it? There was... She drops... I think Jean drops an apple on Charles's head.
Yeah.
Which is a bit of a... I suppose, quote, unquote, common thing to do. So the father says, we're crooks, we're not commoners. And I love that setup of...
Yeah.
We are... con men and women, but we will only be going for big game.
Yeah.
In that single three, in those three words, it's set up.
Yeah.
Who these people are and yes. who their target is.
Yeah.
Just trying to say that super long-winded bullshit.
Yeah.
That this is the dialogue, and you'll see it throughout the whole film, is so polished.
Yeah.
And it comes back to your, like, your whole meaty situation. Fucking whatever.
I'm telling you that, like, yeah. No.
I'm not an eloquent man.
But, yeah, I think, like, now's as good a time as any to jump into the actual performances themselves, because, as we've kind of previously mentioned, that is what anchors this film and kind of really makes you latch on and want to continue watching. What I thought was really interesting... is, and this is the kind of point I wanted to bring up about the editing and the camera work, it's something you don't see very much in modern day cinema, and it's something I fucking love when you do get to see it. Preston Sturges clearly loves his actors, like he in particular the two leads.
Mm-hmm.
And the scene that stood out to me was when... it's at the end of their first kind of night or whatever, and after Jean has been scared by Emma the snake, and she runs back to her cabin and invites Henry Fonda in, and then we have a nearly 5 minute long dialogue scene that is left in a single take close up of just their faces while she's rubbing his hair.
Oh, it's when he's on the ground and she's on that,
on the couch or on the chair.
Yeah.
And their faces are next to each other and she's rubbing his hair.
She's wooing him.
Yes. And it's a 5 minute long scene held continuously on a close up. And that's the point where I was like, oh fuck, these performances are incredible. That they are. He doesn't need to cut at all.
Would you? I mean, because those. The characters are pulling such a fucking fantastic performance. Yeah. Why bother? Just let him do their work.
Exactly. He doesn't need to do fancy camera work. He doesn't need to cut away. He doesn't need to edit like a fiend. It's like that. That's the magic of that film, is their performances.
Yeah.
And it's like, that's all I need.
Yeah.
Like, yeah. And it's fucking amazing to see.
You know, it's like, this is, I think we've never talked about this, but I was going to say that it's one of those situations where it'd be great, as a theatre piece.
Well,
but then it's not really great as a theatre piece, because you want the close-up. You want to let the face do a lot of the work, as opposed to...
You can execute that well, though, on stage with simply doing a spotlight, I feel. Like, by cutting out all light source on a stage and just having a single spot, and in particular, you can do, like, directional spots where it would be just almost their faces illuminated. That draws you in, even if you can't see. And if the performances are strong enough...
But then there's things happening on the face. There's things happening with the hands and
the
fingers,
little ticks and stuff
that I wouldn't imagine you would really pick up. I mean, some of the crowd would, but some of, like, a lot of the crowd wouldn't pick it up. And that's when the close up, the single long shot close up, really shines.
That's true.
I don't know where I'm going with that, but
no, it's I I'm intrigued. I think this might have actually been a play at some point.
Well, it was a book.
It was a short story, right?
Yeah.
And then was adapted. But I have a feeling it might... I know it was also...
It's a radio play.
Yeah, spoiler alert for the trivia. It was also a radio play, so... But that's interesting. If it works as a radio play, then that is further proof that the verbal performances and the meaty dialogue alone is able to sustain an audience for this story.
But we don't know if the radio play worked.
Yeah, this is true. Listened to
it. Because it might be like an SMS where like 70% of the information is lost because you're just reading
you have no context and you don't have
body language and stuff like that.
That being said, both Charles Coburn and Barbara Stanwyck reprised their roles for the radio play.
Her voice does most of the work.
Yes.
It's fucking... It's very, very sexy. Very sexy, man.
Have you found a new lovely lady?
I could listen to her voice all fucking night.
Yeah.
And he's got a fucking alright voice, too.
He looks kind of goofy in this film, though. I think it's just because I'm not...
I don't know what she really sees in him, to be honest.
Yeah,
because he's a bit of a, paint-by-numbers character. A little bit.
Hmm. He's sweet, though, and he's innocent, I think. That's why...
Yeah, he's a gentleman.
And he's clearly passionate because of his love of snakes.
That's a quirk that I enjoy.
Yes.
And there's also situations where he likes to... He seems to be, like, a forgiving character.
Yeah.
That's very eloquent with the setup of you know, there's that moment where towards the end where he's taken aback by the idea that Lady Eve slept with a person, as when she was
let
a teenager.
Alone like 12, 15 people.
Yeah, but in the first instance, he's kind of really measured and furious, but he's still able to control himself and eloquently put forward that, you know, we should just forgive each other and all that sort of stuff. So that kind of personality trait makes him a fascinating character, but that's a little bit few and far between. I'm not saying that he's a shitty character any means, but he's on the verge of potentially being just a vessel.
Well, at the end of the day, I think the film is about her. Like, she is
the titular character, and it's her film. Absolutely.
And so I think that's why I can be forgiving that he is, you know, he has the eccentricities of being the snake professor and things like that.
Yep.
I'm not even going to try and pronounce that word. Like, he says it a few times in the film, like, what actual type of doctor that is. It's like...
A snake doctor.
Yeah. It's like, begins with O, and it's like a super complex one that I couldn't remember.
I want to look it up. Let's fucking learn something.
But, like... Because the film is her film, like, it is her narrative, really, I'm willing to forgive the fact that he has this one mild eccentricity, and then other than that, he's very kind of cookie-cutter and very kind of generic. I think that's forgivable. In particular as well, because the people that they surround his character with are so over-the-top and overblown caricatures. People like... his fucking valet who begins with an Murgatroy. And
what?
His fucking valet's name was Murgatroy. It was like some weird, ridiculous
name. Do you
mean
the bodyguard?
Yes, yes.
You know what I feel like? I feel like he...
He was in a totally different film.
Yeah, I feel like he was in Titanic, actually.
Yes.
He's like the bodyguard.
Oh my god, he was David Warner in Titanic, right?
I think David Warner channeled this guy.
Yeah.
For his role in Titanic.
Fucking
looked
totally.
Exactly the same.
Yeah.
And it was just just the characteristics, the body movements, the behaviours.
Yeah, and in David Warner has the English version of this guy's weird what-the-fuck American accent, even, in Titanic. It's crazy.
Same character, man.
And then also the dad, Pike Sr., who is like the guy, the brewing magnate, sounds like a bullfrog that is gargling concrete.
He sounds like that, homeless guy in Joe Dirt, or the guy like,
Home where you make it. No, he's got that deep southern accent. Like, he sounds like he's got a mouthful of concrete.
Home where you make it. You like to see homeless naked? Yeah, man. Come down, boy.
Okay, yeah.
Do you remember?
I know what you're talking about now, yeah. Yeah.
That's like, it's a Joe Dirt quote.
Yeah. This is the only time Joe Dirt has ever been mentioned in the same sentence as the Lady
E. He has a legacy. Joe Dirt, the film has a legacy.
Well, the sequel,
and it's that guy.
Well, the sequel just came out.
And, well, I didn't even know that there was a sequel.
Adam Sandler's got to pay his friend's rent somehow.
Yeah. Straight to Netflix. Yeah. Let's not talk about that.
Yes.
Fucking what a downer. So let's draw it back in. I want to talk about some character development.
Yep.
Because the film, as we're obviously painting the picture, that the film is really captivating in the first place, right from the get-go.
Yep.
But the moment when Jean decides that she actually loves Charles on the boat, and that she's actually bashing heads with Harry, the father, gets super fascinating. The idea that Harry is defending his past behavior as a con man versus versus Jean's, say, hope that she can potentially actually just find real love and get on with a proper life.
Yeah.
And it all culminates in a card game where it's the master, Harry, versus the apprentice, Jean.
Yeah.
Battling for not only the future and the past bashing heads together. It's just this fucking amazing scene where the suspense and thrilling nature of it, where you have, is Harry good enough to out sleight of hand his own daughter? And just like the idea that he's going to rob her of potential love.
It's like, and you also have the character play of, is he a big enough man to put aside his profession, his like professional duties to,
and his greed,
to let his only daughter pursue a love in her life. And it's also him having to accept the fact that her love is real and it's not part of the con anymore. And it's
Is she ready to essentially destroy a relationship with her own father for the sake of Charles Pike?
Yeah.
And is she good enough to beat him in a game of cards?
Yeah.
Can she dethrone the best con man she knows? There is so much going on.
But then it's also not just the destroy the relationship with her father, but it's like destroy, I wouldn't say relationship with her father, I'd say partnership with her father.
Okay, let's say that.
Because then you also have the added element of their, like, him being accepting of that change and still being her father.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the whole, I mean, it's like a 10-minute sequence that follows that card game. Amazing.
Yeah.
Fucking, this film, I really like this movie.
Yeah.
I'm suspecting that it's going to be my pick for the last 10 films that we watch kind of situation.
We're only what, three in so far, but yeah, and we've got our first Kubrick coming up, so.
Oh, okay. Well, there's stiff competition then, but
yeah. But no, you're right.
But these, this is fucking like the fourth scene or fifth scene or something, and it's only half an hour into the film, and there's just masterful performances, fucking amazing setups.
Yeah.
So much awesome thematical shit going on, like, fuck, man.
Yeah.
It's a good film.
It really is. On a weird light note, can we talk about that fucking horse?
Oh, the thing that's getting in the way.
Yeah. Okay, there's one scene where the scene where Jean is now undercut, like, you know, she's already blown her shot with Charles the first time, and now she's back pretending to be from England and, well, the Lady Eve, and
we should let's just move on with the narrative and say that the situation is blown up because Charles now knows that he's given the information that they're actually con men and women, and and that the love is now burnt and she is scorned. And
yeah, interesting question at that point, because that was about, 40 minutes left in the movie or so. Like, we've hit the hour mark.
That's like halfway, and it's like act two then occurs.
Yeah. Did you think, like, this is what I thought, and I was wondering if you felt the same, because, like, look at the running time, you're like, we're 50 minutes to an hour into an hour 40 long film, and this has now happened. Oh, is the next 40 minutes, 50 minutes going to be generic? Is this where it's going to kind of fall apart and become generic?
I kept thinking it was going to do that.
Yeah, just be like, Charles and her, like, kind of at odds, and then finally realizing, oh, they do love each other after all.
Yeah, I was just waiting for that.
Yeah, and then it ends up being the most inventive, crazy supervillain scam within a scam plot that just is.
Yeah.
For the sake of nothing, like, for the sake of just, I'm gonna fuck with this guy.
Well, yeah,
it's,
I mean,
incredible.
They go back home to America, and you, at no point do you know what her real motivation is, but she seems to want to get back, because she's scorned, get back at Charles Pike.
It's interesting, because it's established, like, through the way in which he establishes the intent of her plan, especially to Harry, her father, and things, that it's one out of spite and scorn, and she wants to con him and get more money one last time.
Yeah.
But then as the plot unfolds, you begin to slowly realize it's not necessarily a plot of vengeance, it's a plot of, no, I actually did love this guy, and I do want to try and get him back.
That's supposed to be a surprise, right?
Yeah.
I was waiting for it to be just the generic ending where it's like, I do love you, darling, and I do love you too, darling.
But that's the thing, like, she got so deep in with the lie and the con that it was like,
you're not really sure.
How is this actually going to play out? Like, that he ends up, the story snowballs so much that you're like, how the fuck is this actually going to play out? And it so when it does end up being the happily ever after, it's earned. Like, and it's really like, yeah, you guys,
and plus
you worked really fucking hard to get your happily ever after.
But
so
it's
not really
as well, because it's kind of a little bit more complex than that.
Well, you don't really know if it's a happily ever after.
That's right. Like, there's... let's talk about it now, I guess. It's still a really open-ended question. Like, you're still totally prepared for... This couple is going to have to work.
Yeah.
In order to keep their shit together.
Their entire relationship is founded on a bed of lies.
So it's really... This is probably one of the best rom-coms I've ever seen.
Yeah, I will actually agree with that for sure.
Because it manages to keep you guessing the whole time, and even though it essentially falls down to the two end up loving each other,
it's a love conquers all.
You never feel like it's being lazy.
Yeah.
It's never a lazy rom-com.
Yeah.
You know, like, everyone gets the fucking, you know what I mean, by lazy. There's so many fucking lazy rom-coms.
And that's
the problem. That's why we're going, when's it going to turn into a lazy rom-com?
Like, because that's what we're so used to. It's so seldom that you actually get in that genre, a film that actually is decent and elevates and tries to do something different. So
it never falls into, like, just regular tropes.
But
we're really getting ahead of ourselves, because we haven't... We're skipping the horse scene.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, I mean, getting back to the interrupting horse.
Yeah, let's go. Let's go talk about that. Loved it.
Okay. that fucking bizarre scene. I mean, it's not bizarre in terms of the actual narrative and the story and the performances and everything. Like, God bless them. They were trying their hardest. I want to know, like, do you think that was planned, or was that just accidental?
Well, I was watching this with Cole.
Yeah,
and
I was watching it with Claire as well. So
she was... She was paying attention more than I was at that point, because she was certain that Stanwyck was breaking when this horse was coming into play. So I'm not sure whether it's like one of those situations where the director's like, we're going to give them the lines, and then without telling them, we're just going to add the horse.
Well, I started to think that it was like, oh, this wasn't meant to happen. This is a total fucking what the fuck. But it worked so well to keep the scene very light and fun and airy and playful.
This is symbolic of what we're talking about, because the dialogue and the character interactions is very rom-com tropey trash, right? Yeah. But then the idea that you're going to add a horse to just fuck up that whole situation...
Yeah, what the horse is doing is like nuzzling their heads and interrupting the scene. And Henry Fonda, you can see, is doing his fucking best to get his lines out, but he's trying to maintain the horse and keep it in balance.
Exactly.
Like, Claire and I are watching and being like, this can't be fucking planned. This is insane. Who actually plans this scene?
Yeah.
Like, this is weird. And then it cut to the reverse angle of the back of their heads, and Claire said, like, there you go, he's cut away. He doesn't cut to coverage in this film very often. It's always played out in a wide.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And she's like, he cut to coverage. Like, this clearly was a fuck-up and they need to get away. And then they brought the horse head into the fucking... Which makes me think that... The scene was playing out with that horse fucking up, and then they thought, oh, it would be really funny. Like, this is very clearly obvious, and this is a great take, and really funny. So let's add an extra shot.
It could be anything. It could be... It could be that they planned it. It could be that they're ad-libbing and just going, we're going to throw the horse in and see what happens.
But it's that over-the-shoulder shot that we've seen ends on with them watching the sunset, and then the horse's head fucking comes in and joins them. I'm like, that was made up on the day, I reckon. Yeah. That's fucking genius. And so it was weird and bizarre. And
it was a great moment.
Yeah. But that's what this film is. It's just a series of really great little moments.
Yeah.
Did you ever find that the slapstick of Henry Fonda's character got a bit much?
He fell over a lot.
A lot.
And he got a lot of food spilt on him as well.
Yeah.
But I was totally fine with it.
Yeah, it never goes beyond.
Somehow it wasn't derp, even though it should be derp.
I think it worked because he was such a meek character, and he was very kind of like, kind of stuttery and not... He didn't stutter, but like, you know what I mean, kind of very...
Well, I mean, in that situation where we're talking about where he's falling over furniture, he's just met Lady Eve, who looks exactly like this con woman that he met on the ship that he was very much in love with.
Yeah.
So naturally you would be fucking a little flustered, bit at odds. Yeah.
But then it continues, like when they're on the train and things, like he's hitting his head constantly. I think it works to endear the audience to the character. It makes him sweet and innocent, I think, and it's like a nice little added element, I think. It works in the same way that him being a snake doctor, which, by the way, did you ever find out what that...
I can't find it. Let me keep looking.
No, it's all good.
Let me keep looking, because I might have to look up, say, more like snake expert.
Yeah.
Snake expert term. Herpetologist?
No, I could have sworn it started with an O.
Well, a snake expert is called a herpetologist, apparently.
Oh, well.
So.
I thought it was interesting. Like, there was
herp being the vernacular term for reptiles and amphibians.
Oh. Nice.
Herpetologist.
I thought it was interesting. Like, for the first, like, hour of the film, I was kind of like, why the fuck... Like, I was curious why the film was called The Lady Eve. And so I started kind of imprinting all these little things on the film, being like, oh, okay, so it's about a woman who is, like, in a roundabout way, it's like kind of referencing back to Original Sin. It's like a woman corrupting a man, like, theoretically that's her plan from the get-go.
That's loaded, man.
I that's what I'm saying. That's her plan initially. It's not what ends up happening. It's that whole idea of that's what... You know, she's aiming to con him and things.
Okay.
And then, you know, we get the opening credit sequence is an animated thing with a snake, having an apple, and then you've got the added thing of he is the snake doctor, and then she drops the apple on his head.
The temptress.
Yeah, and it's the Adam and Eve kind of elements to it. And so I started kind of trying to work that out, and then I was so happy when it was just the standard, like, oh no, her second guise is she's the Lady Eve. And I'm like, oh, thank God. Because that was, like, drawing a short bow of trying to apply meaning.
Yeah, it's like it's an odd title.
Yes.
Because you don't learn about her until the last third of the film.
Yeah.
So, you could just as well have called her fucking any of her other names.
That's true. Well, the original title of the short story and what the actual working title for the film was The Two Hats. So, The Lady Eve...
Isn't that something to do with the book?
That's what the original book was called.
Yeah, okay.
And then, the working title in production of this was The Two Hats, and then Paramount were like, change it.
Yeah. You need something more flashy, man. Something more jazzy, dude.
Yeah. But,
something like The Lady Steve, or The Lady... Let's go Eve, maybe.
Yeah. you know what's a big hit for Fox? All About Eve. Let's take that. But yeah, no, I kind of, that I thought was, like, looking through my notes, like, I'd written a whole bunch about that, but then, you know, it kind of plays out as the film does, and then there's an added little bit in the trivia that kind of really fucks up that point. Oh. So, yeah. I was just intrigued to see if you had a similar kind of interpretation at all, until we get the reveal of her name being Eve.
I thought she was called Eve for, like... 20 minutes.
And then you're like, oh wait, it is Jane.
And then it was Jane.
Yeah. So, okay. Yeah.
Well, in my notes, it also it says Eve.
Eve, constantly.
Like, long before I should have said...
long before the, like, hour mark.
Long before
comes
Eve
in
was
as
a thing.
Eve, yeah.
So, yeah.
Well, I mean, was there anything else you wanted to address before we jump into trivia, or are you good to move on?
No, I think I'm good.
You good?
We're how many minutes?
We're at
42. Okay. I think... I feel like I could talk about this more, but it will probably just be parroting just moments that I really enjoyed.
Yeah.
So I don't think that's absolutely necessary.
You don't want to end up being one of those ones where like, and this scene was cool, and this scene
yeah,
was cool.
Yeah, I don't think that's necessary, yeah. Because the film was let's just say that, I'll say that the film was just filled with great moments.
Yeah. It's masterful filmmaking, and it's a pinnacle of the genre. It really is. Like.
Yeah, and if you like rom-coms, you got to see it.
Yeah, it is one of the best I've ever seen.
If you haven't already seen it. Which
yeah.
you probably
Which, I'm, I mean, if you've listened to this...
We're acting on the assumption that you have seen it.
Because otherwise, spoiler alert.
Well, we never even say that because...
Yeah, because it's...
Maybe
yeah.
we should, dude. Maybe in
We did a while... We did... We used to kind of occasionally be like, oh, spoiler, then this happens. But then we kind of reached the assumption of like...
Who the fuck is listening
to this? It's a very specific film to be listening... Like, who goes out of their way and listens to a Lady Eve podcast without having seen the film? Unless they enjoy us rambling. Which...
Yeah.
All power to you.
Yeah, good on you. Probably stop that.
But all that being said, like, you know, keep doing that, but also watch these films. Yeah. But yeah, we'll move on to actual trivia for the movie, of which I have a fair bit. So the film was nominated for an Academy Award for Best Original Screenplay at the 1942 Oscars, as well as being listed as one of the top 10 films of the year by the National Board of Review. And in 1994, it was entered into the National Film Registry in the Library of Congress. So it is preserved in that vault.
I love that the screenplay would get a nod.
Yeah.
Because that's probably the best part of the film.
Yeah. I am honestly shocked that Barbara Stanwyck didn't get a nomination.
Yeah.
Like, for any major. There was no Oscar, no BAFTA, no National Board of Review. Like, nothing.
That is odd.
No recognition for the acting, which I thought was a little bit odd.
What else has she done? Because...
Well, the big one that stands out to me is... Double Indemnity, as I said, like, that is a fucking phenomenal film. That was I saw that in, like, when I was, like, 13 or 14, and that kind of made me fall in love with film noir. There is, like, the proto-film noir, I feel. It's a fucking fantastic Billy Wilder movie.
Okay.
That, I think, should... If you love Barbara Stanwyck, put that on the top of your list. So, back to trivia. Preston Sturges wrote the screenplay specifically for Barbara Stanwyck. He had promised her a great film while working on a previous movie with her. I'm not actually didn't do my research. I should know which one that was. Meh.
It's one of the other ones, like Lost in.
Yeah.
Play, so
we've already mentioned. We kind of already talked.
Look
about...
Look it up yourself.
We already talked about the how the film had been adapted as a radio play in 1942. So meh. Edith Head's first in a long line of costume designing. This film was Edith Head's. First line in a long line of costume designing specifically for Barbara Stanwyck. The wedding gown that she wore actually caused a fashion sensation, so much so that it was copied for brides, so much so that it was called the Lady Eve dress.
Man, her dresses,
yeah,
her costumes were outstanding.
Yeah.
There was this odd hat that she had, this
yes.
like long beanie thing
yeah.
that was like something out of fucking Harry Potter or
yeah.
something. Awesome.
Mm-hmm.
I'd love to just have this film in colour just to see what her
what they
dresses
have,
were
yeah,
really
something.
Like. Because
oh
they were right. yeah pretty special. Cole was enjoying the shit out of them.
Mm. The book that Charles is reading during his first dinner aboard the ship is entitled Snakes Are Snakes Necessary? This is a spoof on the book Is Sex Necessary? By James Thurber and E.B. White.
That's good because there was a really... That mirror scene started with a close up of that and drawn out, and I was like, I don't get it.
Yeah.
So good, thank you for clearing that up.
Mm. In 1939, Preston Sturges consulted with producer Albert Lewin about his early draft of the script, and among several criticisms, Lewin responded that he felt that the first two thirds of the script, in spite of the high quality of your jokes, will require an almost 100% rewrite. Lewin reasoned that the sequence showing Charles as being inordinately fond of snakes served no purpose.
It is just the tacked-on thing.
Yeah, and that it should be ruthlessly excised. Sturges responded with a letter in which he agreed that the sequence as yet had no connection to the rest of the film, but he admittedly stood by them. In his follow-up letter, Lewin surrendered unconditionally to Sturges' demands and added that, "Follow your witty nose, my boy, and it will lead you, me, and Paramount and the Elysium to the Elysium pastures of popular entertainment."
Okay. It's a, when this film started, it was... It's a Paramount film.
Yep.
Why is the Universal logo at the front, at the start of it?
I had a bunch on that, but I cut it out because I thought it was totally mundane and unnecessary. Paramount and MGM at that time sold the rights of 700 films to Universal, okay. And this is one of the lot of
700. We'll just leave it at that then.
Yeah, it was... Yeah.
It's as simple as that.
So it was a Paramount production at the time, but Universal now owned the distribution rights.
That was weird.
Yes.
It's weird seeing Universal and then a Paramount.
Yeah. Friends of Preston Sturges, who read the script, tried to convince him to cut the number of pratfalls taken by Henry Fonda, arguing that they were both that they were too much of a good thing. Sturges didn't agree, and that the slapstick bits later proved to be among the film's highlights.
Yeah. They're definitely highlights, but some of them. There's a moment I think when it went too far when Titanic fellow just was looking through the window.
Oh, and his
and he just
that
fell
was the
into a bush,
derp,
and that
was
super
derp.
Derp. Yeah.
Yeah, it worked really well. I think the rule of threes was perfect for the Henry Fonda getting food spilt on him. That, like, when that third one came and he stood up and knocked the coffee tray over himself, I was like, well done. You
do you know? Do you know what I think about that moment? Is they cut away too soon?
Yes, it needed to linger.
I was gonna laugh, and then it just cut away.
But what I feel that was, it's like we had the joke curtain call. Like, that's what that
it's
was.
Too,
like, it's lead
still
it quick.
That's why I'm saying that the editing was just a little bit weird.
Yeah.
Because if it lingered just a little bit more, that joke would have been sold to me. But I felt like I was kind of robbed.
Yeah, I can see that. Actually.
I don't know. That's like maybe subjective. I mean, it's clearly subjective, but
I think what they're doing there is a very theatrical thing. It's like, you end on the gag and the curtain falls. Like, that's what... But it was like the fade to black quickly.
But the gag
like,
is...
Get out on the gag.
But you got to give the gag time.
Yeah.
Otherwise, it's not...
It really is. Like, even a second more, it would have been fine.
Just
I think
a moment.
Right.
I mean, this is how crucial comedy editing is.
Yeah.
Like, you know what I mean? Like, it's fucking... You have to...
It's a matter of frames
on
in some
point.
Cases. Yeah. Barbara Stanwyck and Henry Fonda rarely retired to their dressing rooms between takes. Instead, they used to hang out on the set with Preston Sturges, listening to his stories and reviewing and often rewriting their own lines.
Huh. That's awesome.
I thought that was kind of cool. So it was a very communal experience.
Yeah.
To the extent...
That kind of collaboration is usually better on the whole.
This is also interesting about the life on the set of this one that I thought makes Preston Sturges extra cool. To maintain a light atmosphere on the set, Preston Sturges encouraged visitors, friends, press representatives, and even the general public were free to visit his set and watch all the people work and make the movie. It was an open set. Like, if you could be like, let's just go watch the make of the movie.
That's sweet.
Yeah. He was like, it's a fun comedy. Everyone, come hang out. Why not?
I'd love to actually... It'd be so cool to go and see a film being made.
Yeah.
No,
it's not. Having worked on sets, it gets boring as fuck.
Yeah, no, but as a public... Yeah, but you're there.
Yeah, I'm there. Yeah, you're there
from day
here.
From you know minute one in the morning to
you're there very
whatever
early.
At late at night. So, yeah, you're getting bored. But for the general public,
yeah, it'd be like
it's
well,
really
magic.
Yeah, it'd be fascinating.
Yeah, Paramount was so pleased with Preston Sturges' first two directorial efforts and his work on this film that the studio gave him a more lucrative contract at the end of 1940, paying him $2,750 a week for his work as a writer. And a $30,000 bonus for each film he directed. In the year 1940, he earned $200,000. So that is a ridiculous amount of money for 1940.
Fucking nice it is.
Preston Sturges also handled all of his stars with kid's gloves, but apparently took out his frustrations on the members of his stock company. At one point during filming, he couldn't get Henry Fonda and Barbara Stanwyck to read a scene the way he wanted. He stalked over to the actor William Demarest, who wasn't even in that scene, and barked orders at him, and don't talk so damn fast.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, so he apparently was a lovely man, but took it out on, like, didn't want to, like, upset his actors when they were working, and so he'd, vent to other people. I thought this was interesting, that Preston Sturges wrote the script while in Reno, Nevada, while awaiting his third divorce trial.
He loves romantic comedies because...
He's been through a lot of them. His love life is farcical.
A comedy of errors.
Mm-hmm. And the final bit of trivia. With so many people on the set, Preston Sturges dressed eccentrically so that he would stand out. He usually wore either a bright coloured beret or a hat with a feather in it.
Well, Harvey. That is right.
Yeah.
That's so. Yeah, okay, man. Yeah. Good on you, mate.
A feather and a hat,
you don't say. That is super out of control, dude.
The weirdness and eccentricities of this actually led him to be dubbed the worst dressed man in Hollywood. But, like, fuck yeah.
But that's a good calling card to me if I was the worst dressed man in Hollywood.
Yeah,
you would be pretty proud of that.
You're like, yeah, I'm the worst dressed man, but I make fucking good movies, right?
Yeah. And I'm the worst dressed man.
Yeah.
That's a good thing.
Less about the films.
The guy's doing what he feels he wants to do.
Yeah.
How can you hate on that?
And especially seeing the product he's creating. Like, I mean, shit.
Yeah. Wear what you want, people.
Yeah.
Wear feathers and hats. Put feathers everywhere. Give
and
shit.
Colored berets. Yeah. Fancy berets. So yeah, we'll move on to the that wraps it up for trivia, so we'll move on to the actual Criterion edition itself. The film is still available and in print as a one disc DVD through Criterion that comes with the following special features: an audio commentary by noted film scholar Marion Keane, video introduction by writer-director Peter Bogdanovich, the 1942 broadcast of the Lux Radio Theatre adaptation performed by Barbara Stanwyck and Ray Milland, Edith Head's costume designs, as well as a scrapbook of original publicity materials, production stills, and original theatrical trailer.
Are you going to get this as your collection?
Maybe. I really, really, really like this movie, so I might actually do that next time there's a Barnes & Noble sale or something.
Okay.
I would do it next Criterion sale, but they don't ship internationally, which is a bummer.
Well, maybe they really should hard change for that.
Yes, if you're anyone at Criterion is listening, please... Send to
Help
a ship
Chris
to Australia.
Out. Yeah, for Chris.
Yeah, for my sake.
For Chris.
Yeah. But I guess if you've got nothing else, that'll probably wrap us up for this week's episode, looking at the Lady Eve.
Yeah, I have to feed Harv so bad.
Yeah.
He's pacing.
We'll be back next week when we look at Double Suicide, another 1960s Japanese film.
Excellent.
Yes.
Excellent.
But if you have any comments or queries or think we've missed anything, send us an email at thecriterionquest@gmail.com or hit us up on Twitter.
Do other things.
Yeah, I actually haven't told you this. I have posted your artwork to the Criterion subreddit.
Oh shit, okay.
Yeah.
Oh my god.
My art.
I'm exposed.
Yeah, so also have a look on the Criterion subreddit and you'll see a post of...
Yeah, I'll try and do a piece of art for every film from now on.
Yeah.
Because it's fun to do art.
And they're pretty fantastic, so I've been posting those to Reddit, so jump on the Criterion subreddit and, yeah, just join that subreddit. It's a good one. Yeah.
Yeah, Reddit, man. Fucking waste time on Reddit. It's good.
But for this week's episode, I'm Chris.
And I'm Tom. See you next time.